Morning. How are you all today? Good. I'm Scott Tenoda. I've been a member of this fellowship here for 7 years, and I welcome you. We welcome everyone here, regardless of your past, your experience, your theology, what you believe. We come here with open minds, warm hearts to explore together, to think, to believe, to act. Today's service, we're going to be talking about... Oh, announcements first. You will notice in your order of service, if you open it up on the one side, a number of announcements. But in addition to those, I have a couple others here. First of all, I've got an announcement from Social Action. We are collecting perishable food items for the bread basket, the Super Bowl, S-O-U-P-E-R, Super Bowl. Collection boxes are in the narthex. If you want more information about what you might do there for non-perishable foods, you know what that means, though. But if you'd like to bring those in, what's over the next couple of weeks now? Is that what?
This Sunday, next Sunday, and Super Bowl Sunday, and Chili Night.
Chili Night, also.
Four opportunities.
Great.
To bring cans and boxes.
Four opportunities for canned and boxed food. Thank you. The last one is the Chili Night, and that's the other announcement I have for you. On February 9th, we are having a Chili Fiesta open to friends, members, anybody else you might want to invite. We just ask that you get some reservations in. These are inside the order of service. If you think you're interested in, then fill one of these out and get them to Elka Lorenz. Elka, if you would raise your hand. All right. And if you are brand spanking new here and you're sort of not sure what this is about, you are entirely free to come to this too. Speak to Elka about what that's like. All right, so in today's service, we're going to be talking about processes of taking materials, making things, and creating meaning, and sharing ideas. This morning, we're going to follow the Unitarian tradition of lighting a chalice. This is your cue, Nick. Nick is going to light the chalice, and from oil and other materials, he is going to create a flame, symbolizing truth, the search for meaning, love, compassion, a variety of other things. And that flame, the electrons of that flame, when they settle back into their atoms, are going to share some light with you. Thank you. With this lit chalice, I'd like to share this reading from Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. Everyone must leave something behind when he dies, my grandfather said. A child or a book or a painting or a house or a wall built on or a pair of shoes made or a garden planted. Something your hand touched some way so your soul has somewhere to go when you die. And when people look at that tree or flower you planted, you're there. It doesn't matter what you do, he said, as long as you change something from the way it was before you touched it into something that's like you after you take your hands away. The difference between the man who just cuts lawns and a real gardener is in the touching, he said. The lawn cutter might just as well have not been there at all. The gardener will be there a lifetime. Please stand as you're able. And join us in singing hymn number 298, Wake Now My Senses, We Have No Accompanist. We'll have some people leading us in front. 298.
Notice when you finish verse 3, verse 4 and 5 are perfectly followed the next page.
Right. Wake now. Thank you.
Thank you. In this morning's service, we have the privilege to be joined by two KSU faculty, Dylan Beck, Amy Santaferraro. Dylan and Amy are going to talk about, making things, why they make things, how they make things. All the things they make aren't just ceramics, they're grounded in the ceramics tradition. Ceramics is part craft, part art, requiring knowledge of materials as well as a vision of what one wants to accomplish. And I think we'll get a sense of how quite different ways sometimes they both work not just for themselves, but also to create some broader impacts in the world. If this is your first time here, or you're relatively new to Unitarian Universalism, you might wonder how a couple of art professors talking about art is a religious topic. Well, for some of us, it isn't. And for some of us, that's just fine. We don't want religion here. But for others, the fact that we're talking about it on a Sunday morning makes it religious. All right, that's kind of convenient, too, I think. Whatever we talk about, there we go. By definition, it's a religious topic. No, but really, we come together from a variety of different backgrounds. We got different religious views here. Atheists, agnostics, pagans, Buddhists, Taoists, Christians, non-Christian theists, whole gamut of different types and people here. What joins us is not where we come from or our theological beliefs, all right, but where we're going and how we plan on getting there. We join together with progressive visions to make a difference in our lives and in other people's lives, respecting both science and spirit. And I hope that you'll find this service fits into that picture. And we do have a few people here who may not have been, who may be newish, and we've got people who have been here a long time. And I'd like to invite you all to turn to a neighbor, say hello, say good morning, introduce yourself if you don't know who that person is. And good morning back to you all. Thank you. Thank you. A very exciting morning. And the young ones want to introduce themselves to everyone. In this fellowship, and in many Unitarian Universalist fellowships and congregations around the country and the world, we take time out to share significant moments in our lives, those major events that fill us with grief or joy. When we share, our sorrows are lessened and our joys are multiplied. If you have something you'd like to share with everyone here, a major event in your life, something you want to tell us all, the mic will come around.
Hi, Ann March, and I just want to thank everybody for your expressions of sympathy for the loss of my dad. Thank you.
On February 2nd, I'm going to do the Polar Plunge, which I'm collecting donations for the Special Olympics. Excellent. My goal is $500.
Wow.
The Manhattan goal is $23,000. Last year I collected $350.
Excellent.
Goodbye. Shirley Hobrock, membership chair. We have another joy this morning. Victoria Martin, if you stand up, is a new member now.
Thank you.
I have a joy, too. My great-grandchild was born this week, and the father and mother both have studied world religions, and they tend to think out of the box, and the name they chose for her is Yoshiavid, and it's Anastasia is the middle name, but Yoshiavid, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, was the wife of Moses, and the mother who had the baby has converted to Judaism. And the father is an Orthodox Christian, so they kind of mix things up.
Neat. Congratulations.
On Monday, I'm going to do a special audition thing. It's a special thing for my first grade classes, Mrs. Bergabas's class and Mrs. Cool's at Bluemont. All their parents are going to be there, and it's going to be a big thing for me.
Oh, exciting. Please take a moment to honor those joys and sorrows, both spoken and unspoken. We're going to change the order of service slightly. We're going to jump right into the offertory next, in which we graciously accept the gifts that help us as a fellowship pursue our joint goals. And let me just say something about the offering for the music. During the offering, we have a little bit of a silly song about some of the raw materials of art from the album Got No Strings by Michelle Schacht. And then the story for all ages is going to be right afterwards. So if any kids want to, during the music, come on up and join me, feel free to do it while the music is playing. This morning, I'm back to reading a book. This is a book that was I remember reading a while ago and was recommended also to me by Dylan's wife, Anna, who is a phenomenal artist and makes great pottery herself, too. I love this book. This is The Big Orange Splot. Mr. Plumbean lived on a street where all the houses were the same. He liked it that way. So did everybody else. Mr. Plumbean's street. This is a neat street, they would say. And then one day, a seagull flew over Mr. Plumbean's house, and he was carrying a can of bright orange paint. No one knows why. And he dropped the can, also no one knows why, right over Mr. Plumbean's house. It made a big orange splot on Mr. Plumbean's house. Ooh, too bad, everybody said. He's going to have to repaint his house. And he said, yeah, I suppose I will. But, you know, he didn't do it right away. And everybody started to get a little annoyed. They started bugging him to paint his house. So he did. He got some paint. And he painted it overnight when it was cool. In the morning, people came out in the street, and all their houses were the same. But Mr. Plumbean's house was like a rainbow. It was like a jungle. The next page is even better. It was like an explosion. The people said, Plumbean has popped his cork, flipped his wig, blown his stack, and dropped his stopper. And they went away muttering about the stripes and the little orange spots and the pictures of elephants and lions and pretty girls and steam shovels. And that night, the next night, Mr. Plumbean did something different, and he added something else. A clock tower. And the next day, the people said, Plumbean has gushed his mush, lost his marbles, and slipped his hauser. They decided they would pretend just not to notice. And then the next night, he added some more stuff. A bunch of green things, palm trees, baobabs, thorn bushes, hammock, and an alligator. When the people came out of their houses, they saw Mr. Slumbean swinging
on a hammock drinking lemonade. Oh, yeah, I know, with the alligator on his front lawn. Plumbean has gone too far. This used to be a neat street, they said. Plumbean, what have you done to your house? And Plumbean said, my house is me, and I am it. My house is where I like to be, and it looks like all my dreams. People went away, and they asked his next-door neighbor to talk to him. His next-door neighbor did talk to him. And they sat all night under the palm trees, drinking lemonade. And the next morning, when everybody in the town woke up, this is what they saw. They saw a red and yellow strip next door, chip next door to the house of Mr. Plumbean. You think he may? What have you done to your house? They asked the man, and he said, my house is me and I am it. My house is where I like to be, and it looks like all my dreams. And he had always loved ships, it says right here. He's just like Plumbean, the people said. He's got bees in his bonnets, bats in his belfry, and knots in his noodles. And one by one, they went to talk to him at night, drinking lemonade and talking all night. And one by one, the street changed. The houses all changed, one by one. Like that, too. Look at those. Those are not looking the same anymore, are they? It might be. Whenever a stranger came to the street of Plumbean and his neighbors, the stranger would say, oh, this is not a neat street. But all the people would say, this street is us, and we are it. Our street is where we like to be, and it looks like all our dreams. Oh, there. All the houses got painted, and they don't look the same at all anymore. There are a lot of lessons you could kind of think about. There are a lot of things to think about in this book, and one of them that I think is kind of neat is that sort of Mr. Plumbean, his idea came. He had been living all this time on this street that where all the houses look the same, and the idea came just because of this thing that happened. He worked with what he had, the big orange spot, and that kind of that got him thinking. But there are lots of other stuff here about sort of doing things on your own, the way you want to be, and what effect it has on other people. What effect did it have on other people when Mr. Plumbean decided to paint his house like who he is? What did that do for other people?
Make them feel that maybe they should be unique instead of all the same.
Yeah, it gave them a chance. It gave them what was that? Why do you think they weren't like that before? I mean, what was it that was kind of keeping them down before, do you think? Yeah?
They liked all their houses the same.
They liked all their houses the same, but then they changed their mind, didn't they? They had a new vision of what the world could be like. I think that's pretty neat. One person did it, and not even just with one person. The seagull did it, too.
It's like, so maybe another lesson is maybe the first way is not always the right way. Maybe you could do it other ways also.
That's a great lesson. I like that one, too. Well, we're going to be talking about stuff like this once you guys all leave. I love the great big orange spot myself, so I think it's a cool thing to keep on remembering. Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot, kiddos. We'll see you. Before Dylan and Amy start speaking to us, I've just got one more reading. This is a reading from this person, Andy Rutledge, and it's actually on online web design, but I think it's kind of neat. Andy Red says, any reference to constraints that limit creativity.
That's just another way of equating creativity with self-expression. And Andy says, it's an erroneous and irresponsible idea. Except for personal projects, self-expression has no place in design. But, and this is the neat part, I think, constraint is vital to design. No component fuels creativity more than constraint. Indeed, without constraint, creativity and design is irrelevant. The discovery process is mostly about finding constraints, which is why we do such a thorough job of it. Dylan and Amy next.
Hello. I'm honored to have the opportunity to speak with you today. And I think the way I look at my art practice and making art, for me personally, is a way to communicate the things that I care about. And it's a visual communication. When communicating difficult and controversial messages, it's often counterproductive to speak authoritatively or heavy-handed. People with differing views will often become defensive or simply shut down. I use my art practice as a way to start a conversation about the issues that are important to me. So in my artistic practice, I explore the interaction between built space and the natural environment, and also ideas that man-made landscapes express a society's material, political, and spiritual priorities. The idea that cultural priorities are expressed through man-made structures can be seen throughout history. So this is burial mound was built about 3,000 years ago near where I grew up in southeastern Ohio. And it can give us some clues about the Fort ancient culture. And what I think is interesting is if you go to this place on the ground, you have no sense of the design. You can't see this image of a snake eating an egg. And the people who built it had no way of having aerial photography or flying, you know. And so you could imagine that they weren't necessarily building this for themselves or for earthbound people. Now, if you compare that to, if you compare Serpent Mound to Franklin Mills Mall just outside of Philadelphia, not only do we find an uncanny design relationship, but what does this monumental structure tell us about our culture? I'm interested in these reoccurring design relationships, like the design relationships between shipping containers, big box stores, and shopping malls. And another interest of mine is how we attempt to understand and negotiate space through the use of maps and schematics. Consider design relationships that have developed from the top-down organization of computer circuit boards and the bottom-up organization of our cities. And so, in this city, there wasn't necessarily an overall plan. There were probably multiple, well, this is just a few city blocks, but there were probably multiple developers that were in charge or buying up different plots of land and building what they wanted to build. But you have this kind of emergent pattern. And it's interesting to me that is really this, the emergent pattern is very similar to the top-down kind of organization where somebody, one entity is in control of what's happening. And so those kinds of reoccurring patterns are, I find really intriguing. So the organizational relationships aren't merely visual. Information is stored and transported in many of the same ways that and goods and people occupy and traverse urban environments. And so these are some of my attempts to kind of illustrate this. And I often think about the only information that we have about some ancient cultures are the ceramic objects that they created. Most everything will biodegrade or disappear. This is a porcelain cast of a styrofoam shipping form that you would find like on the corner of a DVD player. And so I wonder how will our culture be viewed thousands of years from now when archaeologists unearth our non-biodegradable objects. Much of the development of the built landscape has been emergent, where only loose local codes determine the overall structure of our cities. In this performance piece, I unpack modular units and arrange them in an emergent pattern, reminiscent of a suburban development. As the houses are unpacked, they fill up the exhibition space and push the viewers against the wall or out of the room entirely. Directly imposing on the viewer what is indirectly occurring in our built environment when private space crowds out public space. And this work stands in contrast to the bottom-up emergent organization of much of our built environment. So a single entity, me, has created the structure to organize these parts. And then in an attempt to understand how our cities evolve into complex organized structures, I use the bottom-up organization of emergent growth to determine the placement of these ceramic objects that were made from the interior casts of styrofoam shipping containers, so that negative space that's actually designed to protect a product. And the placement of each piece is determined by the placement of the previous one or the shape of the room or maybe what mood I'm in. On the ground, these emergent landscapes, the organization breaks down. It's difficult to situate oneself. These neighborhoods are often designed to be confusing in an attempt to discourage outsiders. The condition of supermodernity has created places that have no relationship to the natural environments in which they reside, which I would argue that this building that you have here has a great relationship to the natural environment, being up here on the hill and taking advantage of this beautiful view. And so there are ways that we can kind of address our development practices in a responsible way. Let's see. This neighborhood in this image here could be anywhere. This one just happens to be in Normal, Illinois, which unfortunately lives up to its name, if you've ever spent any time there. So I associate suburban development with cellular division or cancerous growth. You might have noticed that what has always been an open field can seemingly overnight become a shopping plaza or a housing development. And while looking at satellite imagery of neighborhoods, rooftops begin to resemble crystalline structures growing and multiplying to fill any available space. And so this image is a fine example of emergent development. There are multiple contractors required to install a security system, HVAC, lights, and signage with no master plan. And I couldn't resist the opportunity to build a McMansion in all that mess. So all of this development requires natural resources. What great lengths we will go to in order to ensure progress. This piece is made from a mold of OSB, which is a typical building material. It's chipped up wood, seemed like the perfect illustration of how we shred up nature and chicken McNugget it into whatever convenient shape we need. Or how we deem some natural areas better than others and our commodification of our natural wonders. In our attempts to tame nature, we go to great lengths to modify the landscape or suit our immediate needs. It seems like there is often a total disregard for the existing natural landscape, which goes hand in hand with the decline of decorative architecture. I often think about how living in a decorative or ornate environment is intellectually stimulating, and what effect our current dumbed-down architecture might have on us. This image perfectly illustrates our society's priorities. This beautiful example of classical architecture has just become a pedestal for a billboard. And this is my attempt to prop up declining decorative architecture against the modern box. On the left, we can see that the cell phone, let's see here. Oh, while living in Philadelphia, I noticed how much the beautiful decorative architecture was being covered or hidden by signs and cell phone signal repeaters. This total disregard for history and the visual landscape creates what is called a visual pollution. And especially in a city with such rich history as Philadelphia, you'd hope that this wasn't a prevalent practice. So on the left, we can see the cell phone signal repeater has been given the esteemed position on top of a church. Then on the right, we see the owner of this building noticed how unsightly the repeaters are and has applied some urban camouflage. In my repeater series, I'm particularly interested in the historical hierarchies of architecture and how these hierarchies can change depending on the desires of a culture, and how we laughably try to disguise the unsightly in rural and liminal zones. Even though I'm being critical of these structures, I understand that I benefit from and get frustrated when I have bad cell phone reception. I just think that we could put a little bit more thought into the design and placement of these things. This image of the information tower hovering above us while rays of electromagnetic fields radiate outward and is suggestive of religious iconography. We must ask ourselves, we have become so dependent on our information infrastructure that we are beholden to it. Where does all this information go? And the air must be thick with words. How do these structures and the electromagnetic fields they produce affect the natural environment? Electromagnetic fields have been proven to affect bird migrations, flight patterns of honeybees, and increase the risk of cancer in humans that live within the vicinity. Our first wireless communication infrastructure was built in the 1950s in the midst of America's greatest development phase. With the advent of television, the Cold War, and the need for transcontinental communication of sensitive governmental information, microwave stations were built across the country. And now, traveling through the expansive West, one no longer has uninterrupted vistas of the plains and mountain ridges. These microwave sites are now relics of a not-so-distant period, illustrating how quickly our technology becomes obsolete. So as I was searching for a three-dimensional way to represent the broadcasting of information and electromagnetic fields, I came across images and video of ferrofluid, which is a liquid that, when excited by electromagnetic fields, creates these interesting conical forms. The state of excitement in a ferrofluid is called a normal field instability. And I find an interesting relationship between the words normal field instability and current reports of negative effects of electromagnetic fields that are emitted from our communication devices. But most recently, I've been thinking a lot about the overwhelming amount of air traffic. And it probably comes from living here in Kansas. I've been living here for 4 years now. And seeing the transcontinental flights above our head continuously. And so on the ground, we hardly notice the thousands of daily flights above our heads, but air travel is an integral part of our economy and American way of life. And living in a location like this, air travel is really convenient and nice. And so using flight patterns and air traffic densities, this field of falling snowflakes simultaneously appears peaceful and menacing. This work was directly inspired by the Kansas Land and Sky. At nearly any time of the day, you can look to the sky and see a number of transcontinental flights, and the air passengers look down and see how we divide up and parcel out the land. Circular irrigation patterns on square plots are represented by CNC milled treated 4x4s. I see an interesting connection between chemically impregnated wood and our current industrial farming practices. I often see beauty in the mundane and sometimes in the very things that embody poor planning and environmental degradation. This condition intrigues me, and I make use of the contradiction in my practice. It is of great interest to me to observe how complex and multifaceted most of the aforementioned issues of planning, development, and environment can be. That is why my work neither condemns nor celebrates the built environment. Rather, it's designed to encourage a more critical discussion of the issues that we currently face. And I think Amy has maybe a more uplifting message.
Thank you for having us. This is a great... I actually just came from Alfred, New York last year, and this day is sort of calming to me and nice when it's rainy outside. So I'm going to share with you some of the collaborative work I've done. I also work as an independent artist, you know, make stuff in my own little studio by myself. But some of the most fulfilling work has been in collaboration. And so in 2008, I became, I guess I was a founding member of Tiny Circus. And it was a group of us that settled in Grinnell, Iowa, mostly because our buddy Carlos's dad had a farm that we could wreak havoc on for a couple summers. And the idea was to start this sort of traveling show where we just, you know, show up in the middle of a town and create some sort of event or entertainment. So this is just the sketch from Popular Mechanics. That was sort of our mascot while we were in the building phases. And so what we did was we bought up some Airstream trailers, and we bought about three or four at, you know, rock bottom prices. They were gross, and we deconstructed all of them and reconstructed them into smaller, more manageable pods, installed solar panels, and also installed birch, really beautiful lining. And the idea was that they would become this sort of like magic lantern that travels from town to town. And just like the orange splot story, we had the ability to make them whatever we wanted. So this was a cloud patch that I cut out and Carlos polished up. And it was great. Every day was different. And there were probably 12 core members. And we lived outside and camped. And we had chickens and we farmed. And it was amazing. And this was a typical day of us sort of getting together, streamlining what needed to happen as far as the construction of, you know, these vehicles that would take us around. And then also the big part of it is creating the animations. And so we were stop motion animation circus. Whenever we said circus, people would say, where are the bears? Where's the strong man? And so it was an amazing, enriching opportunity. And so the woman on the left is Sarah. She's from England. And Grace is from New England. And Sarah was a writer. And so she was a big help in the storyline. So we typically create a storyboard based on some truth or something we take for granted, right? So this one is the history of ghosts. And so we just sort of thought about, like, how do ghosts come to exist? And so that's us filming it. And this is just to show you sort of the technology that exists. Everything is taken in single still photographs. So stop motion animation takes a lot of patience and timing. And, you know, you have to do it under the right lights or else it'll look funny. And then we piece it all together. And so I brought some videos to share with you guys. This is the history of ghosts.
Thank you. I enjoyed both so much. Thank you. Amy, I was going to ask, how long did this last that you went out and took the...
I went to graduate school and now full-time job, I've kind of fallen back. But now that I'm near Iowa, relatively, I'll probably jump right back in. Yeah. Any more questions? Yeah.
Hold on.
2008 was the first summer.
This is a somewhat embarrassing story, like immigrants have lots of embarrassing stories. When we moved from South Carolina to Kansas, to Lawrence, Kansas, where we stopped in Leavenworth for a year, in South Carolina you see a lot of very colorful houses. You know, you see them pink and white and green and blue. And I liked these houses a lot. And so after I became a single woman again, and I lived in a neighborhood in Lawrence, a normal neighborhood, and I painted my house pink, and it caused a real riot in the neighborhood. It was a very tasteful pink. It was not very bright. It was very subdued, but nonetheless, I was not entitled to paint my house in the color that I wanted. And when I sold it, I painted it gray.
Dylan Aurelia, appreciate your art. I like that I can see your thoughtfulness in art. It's not just a painting or something. Not to give anything against painting, but like I really like seeing the thoughtfulness and air expression through. I thought you do a really good job of bringing your points to visual, and I appreciate that. And so.
Just a question. Do you take your projects into art classrooms in public schools or into classrooms in the public schools or any schools?
Yeah, it's a good question. At first, we would go anywhere that would have us because we were this unknown. And now it's been pretty amazing to see what we can, you know, where we can get. And that is one of the service portions of what we do is we're trying to focus on places that don't maybe have the opportunity to think of themselves as artists or creative or, you know, readers of creativity. And in a way, it's kind of sneaky. We sort of come in and say, like, we're going to have this show, but you have to make it, right? So it sort of catches people in a vulnerable but excited sort of point, and it's really fulfilling. And we go now, we have, you know, requests that we can't get to all of them, and it's, you know, solar panels are great, but it still takes a lot of gas to get to get those things everywhere. We're trying to go everywhere.
Dylan, I've always noticed the piece there in Rodina's on campus. I'm assuming that's yours, and so it's nice to have the background for that.
Dylan, my question is for you. When you showed the contrast between, you know, filigreed, real busy stuff, and then just plain as you know, flat and so on. I think about the in music, the nice interaction between you know, things that are real busy and things that are not. So there's a place for all of that in architecture, I would think. You know, in music, they say some performers are known best for the notes they don't play, that are expected, and they lead them out. And I wonder about your comment on that and the connection there.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is has to do with intention. And I think that a lot of the, say, if you drive around where Walmart is and things in Manhattan here, there's a lack of intention. It's pure function. It's what is the cheapest and quickest and easiest way to build something. And if people were to just spend a little bit more time thinking about those relationships, I think we'd have a much richer environment. And so I think that that's my comment to that. I agree, definitely.
I had one more thing for Dylan. I sometimes look out at the trees, not because I'm bored, because they're beautiful and they kind of add for me, ground me or something, but there was a point where you had the kind of the more circular highways in your landscape, and this exact seat where I'm looking, the trees doing the exact same thing that was, and I almost pointed it out to my seat neighbor, but I realized she was at a different angle and wouldn't be able to. So anyway.
I do not think of myself as a creative person at all. I'm organized, but I'm not creative. So when our daughter was very young, I was determined to overcome this flaw in her. And I gave her a puzzle that had blocks and different pictures on each side. And on the back of the box was how you could assemble all the different sides into a box. But, of course, I never showed her those pictures. And she put them together in any way she wanted. So one day my mother came to visit, and she said to my mother, "Let's play puzzles, Grandma." So Grandma said, "Sure." And after a little while, Grandma came to me, and she said, "I can't understand what's the matter with Samantha. She just can't seem to understand that the pictures can be reproduced here." I said, "That's why I'm teaching her creativity, Mother." But that's my question. How do you address encouraging creativity? Do you find, for instance, in your presentations that your children are much, younger children are much more susceptible, conducive to bringing into your program? And what can you do to advance confidence and creativity in the more structural inclined?
Right. Well, I mean, it all starts pretty, we pretty much have a hat with some ideas. So from the beginning, it's everybody's sharing. So I think we've worked with really, really young students, and, you know, really, we've been to nursing homes and all sorts of things. And it all starts from the same place, where we just each write down an idea or a thing that we don't know how it came to be. And so we sort of put it in a hat and then pull it out. And then creatively, we all listen to one another and brainstorm and figure out, you know, can we make this make sense? And that process, I think, is it's really evident to how creative we all can think about one thing if we use all of our brains together. It takes a while sometimes, and we've thrown some back into the hat to never return, but
well, yeah. And I think that Amy and I try to do that in our ceramics program at K-State, is trying to create a feeling of equality and more of an open atmosphere where people, and even in the assignments that we give, just having some loose parameters and focus on, you know, some technical skills. Ceramics is a very technical thing, but then leaving the conceptual part and the idea and the creativity part open, and talking openly about ideas. And then we have critiques in process and finished critiques where we all get together as a group and try to share ideas to improve these things. And hopefully collectively, those ways of thinking creatively can become kind of contagious.
You are both educators. How do you teach creativity? How do you even foster it? I'm a physicist,
Anna,
so give me a suggestion.
Well, I think, like I was saying, creating an open atmosphere where people feel comfortable to share their ideas, I've noticed it's become a lot more difficult with kids that have gone through No Child Left Behind schooling, where they're taught to take a test and not think creatively and have one answer for that test. And so it's really an important challenge for educators today is how to break that, because for 12 years or more they've been taught to think in a very structured way and that there is only one right answer. And so one thing that I do is I try to, at the beginning of class, just have discussion time where I'll walk into the class and just say, how are you guys doing? What's going on? And we'll just talk. And then that can slowly lead into more kind of deeper discussion. And or anytime you ask a question and or someone has a comment and critique or something, it's important to not maybe shoot somebody down, or if someone has an off-color or unusual answer, it's better to maybe say, well, that's an interesting comment, and maybe we can address that, instead of having a kind of a hard-line objective for learning and saying, well, that doesn't fit into what I'm interested in you learning, so let's not even go there. So I think it's really important to keep things open like that and make people feel comfortable to share their ideas, even if they have really kind of crazy, outlandish ideas. Often it might be distracting, but sometimes those crazy, outlandish ideas are the best and most creative. And so if you continually shut them down, then those people that are the most creative will keep their mouth shut.
And on a very, functional level, I always say, you're probably going to get an A if you are present, if you show up and you're engaged and you are present. And then the rules I have are cell phones, no, earphones, no. And it's just about being receptive to everything that's going around in the periphery. A neighbor's idea down the table might trickle away its way down to you and become a whole nother idea just in working, not even communication, just visually seeing what's going on. To just be able to provide an environment where that can happen. And it's different than, most academic classes that they have. So it's a nice, if you can get them on board, they end up enjoying it.
And we have students for 3 hours at a time. And so it's a bigger block of time that we're able to create more of maybe a relationship. And we're doing physical work, and that always gets people thinking in a different manner than just, say, sitting in a desk and watching someone lecture.
Some years ago, I had an opportunity to hear Buckminster Fuller talk, who's a very creative architect, designer. And he made a comment that about creativity that I've never forgotten. He said that we're all born creative geniuses. The question is, how much of it is left by the time we become adults?
That's true.
And he was using that as a critique of the education process, where I think the comment was made, kids get down to one right answer, and creativity is not about one right answer. It's about many answers. And I think that was his point, and I would have liked to have seen that talk video. This was before we did videos of things, and shown every place, because he was absolutely right.
Well, there's another creative genius named John Cleese. I don't know if you're... Well, if you type in John Cleese creativity into YouTube, you'll come up with a half-hour lecture that he gives about creativity. And he's someone who's spent years and years and years, writing comedy. And so being in creative situations. And I've showed that to my students now. It'll give you... He basically gives really good kind of life advice on how to... cultivate creativity in your own life and in the workplace, and I think he's lecturing to business people, and so he's talking about creating creativity within a place that isn't conducive to that, or sometimes may be seen as a threat. Or so, I would recommend checking out that video.
Hi, oh,
You can be next. My name is Jamie, and my heart is racing right now because this discussion is so exciting. I'm a drama therapist. My colleagues are here. We're drama therapists, so we talk about creativity all the time, and I've been waiting for the word play to be brought up. I think it comes down to play and being playful. I have two things to recommend. There's a book called Play by Stuart Brown. Yeah, okay, Stuart Brown, Play. And if you take creative drama with Sally Bailey at K-State, you can learn all about play that way. That's the main focus of the class. The class welcomes, you know, non-degree seeking students, students from all majors. You learn how to play, improvise, create stories, and it's a lot of fun. So I recommend it.
Thank you.
Ann Cowan. Dylan, I'm wondering if you ever get to interact with developers and city planners and how they receive and interpret your work. We could maybe use some here in Manhattan with some of our developers.
Well, yeah, that was one thing that really drew me to Manhattan, or that I was really intrigued by about Manhattan, is the redevelopment and where the placement of the shopping mall in at the end of Points. And so I do have a lot of opinions and ideas, and I've read most of the same kind of literature that they read, and I've been welcomed by the architecture and landscape architecture program here, and have lectured and serve on graduate committees there, and so it's nice to be able to affect change in that way. I often have an internal conflict about, you know, what I'm doing, because I'm just making things that not a whole lot of people get to see, and does it really? Wouldn't it be more productive for me to actually be a planner, you know? But that's not, that path isn't necessarily as fulfilling for me. And so to find a balance of how I can be fulfilled and how I can hopefully affect change in the world, I'm, you know, here speaking with you and doing these kinds of things. But I haven't necessarily worked on any specific projects, but I would welcome the opportunity if there's any planners in the audience.
And I think it's important to note that your father.
Oh yeah, my dad's
a builder
contractor.
And contractor, and so yeah. There is a very intimate relationship there with, you know, just understanding how things can be, and
yeah,
it's pretty cool.
I have Kathleen Oldfather, and this is, my thoughts come from what Abigail was talking about, and then Brian's question, and for me as a parent, sometimes I had to learn just to get out of the way. If I tried to organize an art project, it usually failed. But Michael would often bring home scraps of wood and just put them in the garage. And our son and his friends had more fun building with this wood and making structures and, you know, whatever. And also one day they dragged home an old skateboard. And they built on that skateboard and redid it and reworked it and built it up, took it apart. And I think they worked on that for 3 years on and off. You know, so anyway, I had to just learn to get out of the way and let it be a mess out there. And, you know, that the expressions of creativity came from a lot of sources besides the crayons and the watercolors and the things like that. So,
well, over a lifetime, one recognizes how much natural structures in nature and creative structures that human cognitive ability creates just to really spread to all fields. Just to make it simple, I want to mention that in the construction of molecules, some of the things that people come up often draw upon the names. Take, for example, Buckminster fullerene, which is a compound of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, and it just looked like something Buckminster Fuller had done, so it became Buckminster fullerene. And, of course, you've all heard of buckyballs, which are unique structures as well. So it all comes together in literally all fields.
Uh,
Yeah, I think it's important that we reach those who teach the art in the public schools. Back in the 70s, when my young son was in middle school and took art, and he had battles with his teacher. His project was finished. And she says, oh, no, it isn't finished. He says, yes, it is. And, of course, Mark, you didn't argue. But I think that the sensitivity that teachers need to have if they're going to teach creativity is very important.
Definitely.
We'll have one more. It's time, unfortunately.
My name is Sarah, and before I moved to Manhattan, about 2.5 years ago, I worked for 10 years in nonprofit arts organizations like museums and galleries. And I think that maybe until I moved here, I didn't realize how much that art had become my religion. And then I left working in it and had to seek out another source, which is how I ended up here. And so today you kind of all brought it together for me. And I just wanted to say how nice it was to see that and how much I appreciated it.
Thank you. Well,
thank you. Thank you, everybody, for their comments. Thank you, Amy and Dylan. Please join me then for a quick round, not round, but quick singing of closing hymn number 402 from You I Receive. I think we're going to be led the first one up in front. Thank you.